Hello and welcome back to Don't Overwater Your Succulents, your favorite podcast about trying to keep houseplants alive. I'm just kidding, this is Book Wars Pod, episode 2. I'm here with Kate and Chris, and we're going to be going over the second half of Rebel Rising by Beth Rivas. So,
bestseller, Rebel Rising by Beth Rivas.
Accurate. Yes. All right, what are you guys drinking today?
I finished my bourbon ginger since we're recording this exactly 10 minutes after we recorded episode 1, because we're recording, thanks to technology.
And you didn't refill?
I mean, I'm not saying I'm not going to drink more after.
Oh, CK probably refilled because she's smart.
I think you're making it wrong. No, I'm still working on my first stupid gin and tonic. It's just that, like, small. My tolerance is so low that I'm already, like, buzzed off of half a gin and tonic.
Perfect.
So,
yeah, I mean, all I have to eat today is a bagel sandwich, so.
Same. But it's 3 hours later for you. All this chicken that I have next to me that I'm going to try to not eat directly into the microphone. Because I got hungry during the first episode. Nice. All this Star Wars talk makes me hungry. I'm drinking a Rainier just like I am every second of the day.
Love it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure of all 4 episodes that we've recorded at some point. And if you're listening, no, you haven't missed any episodes. 2 of them just failed. But all 4 episodes, you've been drinking a Rainier.
Yep. Well, that's my go-to. That's my go-to
Rainier,
when I'm not trying
saying,
to get...
If you're looking for podcasts to sponsor...
I don't think they do that. Can we have alcohol sponsors? Probably. It's fine. Just with it. It's definitely their demographic, right? Star Wars book club podcasts.
Everyone's our demographic. So is the Universal Tale.
That's so true. Okay. We are on episode 2, so... Chapter 26 to the end. I think we probably want to jump right in. Chris, do you want to start us off? I know you have big feelings.
I would love to. I mean, I think last episode we started off with a good question that I think can be asked again and get a completely different answer, which is how does Rebel Rising change the way that we see Jyn Erso? Like, obviously, many people know her from Rogue One, and she was in the first half of Rebel Rising very young and pretty idealistic, and, you know, at least up until... Saw left her on Tamsai Prime as the Empire was attacking. But you see a much darker side of Jyn in the second half of Rebel Rising. So I don't know, how does the book change how you all saw her?
Well, in the first half of the book, she's going through some really fucked up shit. And then in the second half of the book, she's also going through some really fucked up shit. So.
Yeah, Jyn can't really catch a break. Jyn kind of feels like she was like 3 years old and living on Coruscant.
Oh, that's so true.
So bad. Jyn. Poor babe.
I know, really.
Yeah, but I think the level of the depth of heartbreak and hurt that she's going through is even more apparent and more intense during the second half of the book than it is in the first half of the book. Because in the first half of the book, she's just kind of, life is just kind of happening to her, right? She doesn't really have a ton of her own agency because, you know, she's living with Saw. And she basically needs to listen to him because he's scary. And and
not
during during the second half of the book, she's obviously on her own because Saul just pieces the fuck out and does not come back for her like we knew he was not going to when he said he was going to. But so she's mostly focused on keeping herself alive. But then we have this hotter Akshaya sort of piece, I don't know, a vignette perhaps of what life could potentially be like. And obviously that is like almost immediately ripped from Jyn, and everybody dies, just like they always do, because it's Star Wars.
Because Star Wars.
Yep.
I think it's like a year or so that she spends on Skull, where she gets this little reprieve where she's, you know, she's kind of concerned about the Empire in terms of at least Akshaya's business and things like that. But other than that, you know, it's just kind of this nice, peaceful period where she experiences love for the first time and all this, you know, this nice stuff. And then, I think she mentions it's the first time she's really felt like she's had an actual, like, true family since she wasn't on Coruscant with her parents or even Lamu with her parents.
Yeah.
You know, there's this really great depiction of a mother-daughter relationship between her and Akshaya.
Yeah, one in a fucking row.
Right?
God. People in Star Wars cannot catch a break with the not having moms.
No one has a mom.
No one has a mom.
I don't.
Well, Anakin had a mom. LOL.
Yes. Had. But there are really none of these mother-daughter relationships. I'm really hoping that when that Princess Leia YA book comes out, that we get to see more of her and Brea, because I'm really interested in that. But anyway, yeah, no, just can't catch a break. I think probably one of the most emotional bits for me is obviously when Hatter and Akshaya die horribly in a fiery blast in space. And I had to put the book down for a few days because I just could not keep reading it. It was just so sad.
I mean,
obviously Hatter was going to die because it's Star Wars, and this is why we can't have nice things.
Mm-hmm. That's the whole point. That's why we like it, right?
You know, it was just it was kind of amazing, though, just amazing and sad, the way that I saw this death coming from a mile away, but Rebus is such an incredible writer, and she's so amazing at writing trauma realistically, that moment where Jin realizes that they're gone, and she sees that bit of the Pontar One embedded in her ship, and it's the slow realization, and we're following it along with her, because Rebus just really, really slows down time. You know, she sees that she's a random piece of metal embedded in her ship, and she's like, oh, what's that? Oh, this is clearly a piece of another ship. Oh, this is not Y-Wing or TIE Fighter colored. Wait, this kind of looks like, yes, it says Pontar One on it. Crap.
It's not good.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you really see in the second half is you just really in a single episode's worth, but in a few hundred pages, you see the complete transformation of Jin, because you go from this young idealistic person who, you know, obviously she's been through some shit, her mother died, her father, you know, as far as she knows, betrayed her and is working for the Empire. But she still, you know, believes in good and evil and believes in fighting the Empire for, you know, idealistic reasons. And you kind of go from that to, you know, right before she's, you know, at least chronologically, right before she's rescued by the Rebel Alliance and K2, from Mobani, you see her when her cellmate Zarada is, you know, they're in the work camp and Zarada is about to kill herself because just life in the prison is so horrible. She looks at Jin and she says, what's the point? And, you know, kind of begging Jin to save her and talk her out of this. And Jin just looks her in the eye and she says, there is no point. There is no point in living. She is so beaten down by everything that happens between...
She's broken.
Yeah, between Saw leaving her to the death of Hatter and Akshaya to everything that happened on Five Point Station and dealing with the slavers. She's broken. That's exactly, it's a wonderful way to put it. And I mean, I think the reason that you, obviously there's many reasons that you see that Jin is broken, but one of them y'all have already kind of touched on, and that's her relationship with Hatter and Akshaya. Obviously, for those who can't remember names, this is the family that she meets on school. Akshaya is the, not smuggler, but I guess...
She's a... I don't know. I love how we're like, we don't know what it's called when people legally... Legally move things.
She's a transport pilot.
Yes.
Transport pilot. There you go.
We're gonna call her that.
We're just used to anybody driving a freighter being a scoundrel.
A smuggler?
Yep.
Scoundrel. But yeah, and so you see this relationship develop, you know, in a time when Jin is very vulnerable. She's 16 and Saw just abandoned her. And you see Akshaya treat her with love, which is something she hasn't experienced since her mother died and her father left.
Especially from a woman, right?
Yeah, especially from a woman. There's not a lot of, I mean, Kate said it, but there is literally no other mother-daughter, positive mother-daughter relationship in the Star Wars universe as of right now that is canon.
Yep, that's accurate. Who knows where Rey's mom is? Who knows who she is? Who knows? We just know that we left.
I'm not going to lie. One thing that I really appreciated is that this book just made it very clear that Jin is not Rey's mom, because the internet's two white ladies who are both have brown hair.
Oh my god. They go on a line floor sometimes. Die. Anyway.
It's
awesome. this dumpster fire of a fandom. It's just but everybody... They could be, and you're that's just because they're really bad at casting anybody who's not white. It has nothing to do with anything besides that. Thank you.
I mean, I was saying to Kate the other day, we saw the pictures of Diego Luna in episode, or not Diego Luna, sorry, of
Benicio del Toro.
Thank you. Jesus.
It's fine. It's hard.
I fixed up Benicio del Toro in episode 8, and I made a joke like, oh, well, there's two people of Hispanic backgrounds in Star Wars, and it's like a 50, 60 year difference. Clearly, Cassian is BJ's father somehow.
I'm sure.
Now watch that actually be true, and I'm just going to scream.
That would be pretty peak. That would not be surprised at all.
Back to Rebel Rising by Beth Rivas. See, like, this relationship developed between Jin and Akshay, and particularly Jin and Hatter, obviously, is a really strong relationship as well. And because they fall in love, and you see Jin kind of fall, I don't want to say fall into this trap, but be lured into this sense that her life can be normal, and her life, she can just live out on school and ignore the Empire, and everything is going to be fine, and she can just be who she wants to be.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, but, she gets super complacent, basically, is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah. We know that she's telling Akshaya not to ignore the Empire, like, that it's a very naive, silly way to think about things, but then we see Jin doing the same thing, but simultaneously, like, knowing that it's going to end badly, which is really interesting. It's just, like, she's so starved of, like, good attention and positive things in her life that she's willing to, like, put, you know, everything she knows to be true aside just for, like, some time of normalcy or, like, relative normalcy.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it just really speaks to Rivas's, she just writes trauma so accurately and amazingly. Yeah. Like, I wish I didn't have the experience to be able to, like, say that, but, you know, it's true. It's incredible writing.
Yeah, for sure. I'm a child. Kate and Chris, do you think they boned? Hotter and Jen? My favorite question.
I'm pretty sure that the traditional YA fade to black is totally code for they totally boned.
Okay, just making sure.
Which,
I mean, I'm just saying, I had Lady Gaga's Do What You Want With My Body stuck in my head for like a solid day after reading that.
An actual line. That's pretty.
My chagrin. Yes.
So
that's probably like the only scene where I was just like, really? But that's just because I don't read a lot of YA, so.
It's fine, because he's a cinnamon roll.
He is a cinnamon roll. He's a good little guy.
Yeah.
That then, like, eventually explodes, like all good characters.
Yeah.
But that, like, kind of takes us to, like, Jin's view of the Rebellion, because obviously, like, Jin doesn't really have a positive view of the Rebellion. Like, when she gets rescued and taken to Yavin in the beginning of Rogue One, and I suppose the end of Rebel Rising, she's really, you know, it's not like, oh my god, the Rebellion, thank god. It's kind of like, these fuckers.
Right, exactly.
And, like, you kind of see the beginning of that, because, like, obviously with Saw, she wanted him to join the Rebellion, but now she doesn't know if the Rebellion blew up the Ponta One, if the Empire blew up the Ponta One. She blames herself, but, and she also talks about how, like, why couldn't the Rebels just deal with everything and stay in their lane, and then there would be no war, and everything would be fine. And so you really see this kind of conflict within her of, she obviously hates the Empire, but, like, the Rebellion has been responsible for a lot of bad shit in her life.
Oh my god, it's almost like she learned that from the guy who raised her.
Mm-hmm. But you do get this interesting progression where she's, like, super gung-ho about, you know, joining the Rebellion until obviously she sees Saw's horrible tactics, and then she, once all leaves her, you know, she leaves the Rebellion because that's just such a source of trauma for her. But when Hatter talks about joining up, she says, you know, I'm not going to join up with you, but you can go do what you want. To just being completely against it and just wanting no part in it. So I thought that was really interesting. The way Rivas actually frames that, kind of actually pretty slow progression to Jin just having completely had it with anything having to do with this war, anything having to do with life, just anything at all.
Yeah, I just love how Beth Rivas developed Jin in this, because you know, you obviously knew where she was going to end up in Rogue One, and, you know, to a certain extent, I feel like if you're writing an 8-year-old, there's only, like, a certain emotional range that an 8-year-old, like, you can write with an 8-year-old, like, they're going to be more idealistic. And so you kind of know where she starts by nature of where in your life you're starting her. It was just such a slow burn. And I don't mean that as in, like, it was boring, but I mean that as in, like, there really wasn't one specific point in her life where it was like everything snapped for Jin and then she saw the light. Like, it was like, no, like, Jin truly is a product of her upbringing and her experiences. Like, it was everything combined to make her just like hate everything and hate the rebellion and hate the Empire and think that there is no point.
Yeah, it was very un-YA-ish. That's not a word, which is why it's difficult to say. Because things are so not black and white in the way that she writes them, which is, you know, it's like life is complicated. Yeah. And there's no, like easy way to boil that down. And she doesn't try to, which is great.
Yeah, just that while we're talking about genre, I just want to say that when Chris and I went to go pick up Rebel Rising at our local Barnes & Noble, they had fucking categorized it under, like, I think it was, like, ages 7 to 12 or something. It wasn't in the YA section. It wasn't in the sci-fi section. It wasn't in the other Star Wars book section. No, it was in ages 7 to 12. Are you fucking kidding me, guys?
Like, there's so much death and destruction in this book.
Oh, no. Like, seriously. It was kind of alarming. Because we'll read it later on the podcast, but I've read the Ahsoka YA book before this. And so I knew, like, they weren't going to fuck around with the violence or anything like that because, you know, there's a lot of fucked up shit that happens in the Ahsoka book. But yeah, it's just, the group's miscategorization was troubling. And we'll talk about genre later with some special guests in future episodes of the podcast. But I just wanted to say that if you're thinking that this is a kid's book, please, please rethink how you are framing YA in your mind.
Much like Rebels. Also, don't let your 7-year-old watch that.
Accurate as fuck.
Like, can you imagine how terrified a 7-year-old would be if they watched Bendu? That kid would not sleep for the rest of his life or her life.
Yes. Or, I mean, I'm thinking also about, like, the Clone Wars when, like, Maul first reappears and he's got that spider contraption on him.
Oh my god, my favorite thing in the entire world. You mean my favorite thing?
I know, like...
Spider-Maul?
Okay, I shit my pants and I'm a grown-up, so...
Yeah, I know, it was scary!
Yes, shit my pants. Anyway.
Very scary.
Yes. Alright, what were we talking about that was actually on topic?
I don't know.
I decided to just kind of let y'all run with it and see where we ended up.
Thanks, Chris!
No more useful, sorry everybody who's lost. Anyway,
No, go ahead.
Oh, no, I just... Going back to the ways that the book really ties into Jin's development, where she winds up in the movie, I really appreciated, there are a lot of moments kind of like this, but one thing that I really appreciated is that Jin specifically, when she encounters Saw for the first time in years and years and years in Rogue One, and he asks her, don't you care about the cause anymore? Like, how can you stand to see the Empire's flag just waving across the galaxy, and she says, it's not a problem if you don't look up. Just, first of all, you know, that line of dialogue alone obviously gives her intense characterization, just showing her complete apathy towards this whole thing. But also, the Rebel Rising offers you a glimpse into how that happened. There's this very specific moment when she's on Five Point Station, right after she finds out that Hatter and Akshaya are dead, where she sees the Imperial flag, and she takes a minute and she's like, oh, I didn't realize that this is how far the Empire stretched. And then she's just like, you know what? I don't care. And specifically, like, very consciously makes this decision to look away from it. And she doesn't really look at it again for a really, really long time.
Yeah, totally. I think you do see that apathy that we really didn't see in the first half of the book. You see it develop here. And, like, again, it's just such a testament to the Star Wars universe and the depth that they're committed to going to and building these characters. Because we have so much more backstory for Jin now, and she's not just apathetic because, oh, I was abandoned and I have no backstory, and so I'm apathetic. Like, no, like, you see this incredibly rich world building, and Jin didn't used to be apathetic, and then she was apathetic, but then, you know, like, you kind of are able to see that switch flip in Rogue One, and you understand what that spark was that still existed in her, and what beat it down in the first place.
Also, Five Point Station sounds horrible. I don't want to go there. It does not sound like a fun place.
It didn't sound fun. It kind of, like, I actually, like, I couldn't remember what, like, the trading post where we first meet Cassian in Rogue One was called. I looked up, fun fact, it's called the Ring of Dufresne. It was not there. But it, like, sounded very similar, like, very seedy, very underbelly. We're going to see, there's definitely, I think, plenty more places like that in the Star Wars universe as we continue reading through the books and the comic books. But yeah, I mean, you see it as kind of a formative place for Jyn. It's like, this is the place where her hope died.
Yeah, and also where she got kind of involved in the underworld, you know, she's... everything she does from that point on is really just the least above board ever.
Yeah, it's pretty illegal.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a really good point because, like, I mean, obviously she was part of illegal stuff when she was with Saw, but that wasn't really her choice. Like, her mom died, her dad left, and Saw was her guardian. And so you're kind of drawn into that world.
If you would like to hear about how questionable we think Saw as a guardian is, please refer to episode 1, where I talk about it at length.
Nice plug.
Yes. And also,
but that,
like,
you see here, like,
I mean,
she's like, I mean, obviously it's to survive. Sorry, go ahead, Kate.
Oh, no, just, you know, at least when she's doing stuff that's illegal, you know, back in the day with the partisans, she thinks she's doing it for a reason. Like, she has a reason for doing it. Like, now it's just, well, I need money, so I gotta feed myself, and, you know, I need somewhere to live, and I need to get off this stupid fucking space station, you know.
It's the worst space station.
Yeah.
What
yeah,
did you guys...
it's totally, like, the death of her idealism on Five Point Station, and then you see, like, she then starts working for the Empire because that's what she needs to do to survive. And that's something that she never would have done before. She never would have considered it before, I don't think. But you do see it here. And that's, again, just a testament to how beat down she is. Also, yeah. Shout out to Captain Solange, the best name in Star Wars.
Woo! Agree. Even though she's a mess, but sure.
Oh, hot mess of a character, but great.
I know. It's like, what had happened was gambling is bad. Got
yeah,
it.
Right.
Great, thank you. Thank you. That's a message for the kids.
Addiction is a hell of a disease, y'all.
Don't gamble. It not good. but, yeah, I mean, and that's how... So her sketchy dealings with the Empire is how she ends up in prison, which is not good. That prison sounds like a terrible place to be as well. I don't know...
So it does.
Yeah. I think in the first half of the book, I was, like, not really into the prison vignettes. And then as soon as we started getting closer to where the regular storyline meets up with the prison storyline, I became more and more invested in them. Did you guys find yourselves, I don't know. Did you like that choice?
I didn't mind it. So here's my thing, because this is how my brain works. My brain enjoys having order and whatever else. I was trying to see if there's a sort of pattern to when the those vignettes popped up, because obviously we have a few. I think we have 3 sprinkled out the main story, and then like the last couple are just all bunched up together towards the end. And one pattern I noticed, because I'm a giant nerd and I look for these things, is that whenever the vignettes popped up, it's a place to pause right after Jyn gets abandoned by someone. Yeah, so, like, you know, there's one that pops up immediately. Yeah, there's one that pops up right after Jyn gets left in the bunker and Saw leaves on Tamsai Prime. And then there's another one after Hatter and Akshaya die and she's all alone. You know, and it's just like kind of... It's just this really incredible, masterful way to just kind of reinforce that sense of just complete loneliness and isolation that's just been a theme throughout Jyn's life. And I thought and once I figured that out, I thought that was actually a really masterful way to kind of hammer that home. It was really interesting.
I'm mad I didn't notice that, and now it's making me want to go back and read it again with kind of noticing that a little bit more.
Yeah, skim through. It's kind of fun.
kind of fun. Yeah, death fun. Destruction. Fun. Kind of fun.
Yeah.
You know.
So one other thing that I want to talk about is kind of we see Jyn's development and her devolution into apathy. But one thing that I was really struck by is you never actually really see Jyn kill anyone. Like you see, that's not true. You see her, you know, when she's escaping from school, she probably fries some stormtroopers with her rock boosters. But you never see her actually look someone in the eye and kill them. In the first half, you have when Saw and she's on Saw's raid, and you have like there's a scientist coming toward her who's like probably about to grab her weapon, and then one of the partisans shoots him. And then there's the other bit with the slavers in the second half of the book, you know, transferring them from one of the 5 points planets to another one, where she like locks all the slavers in the airlock and then basically just like gives the keys. Just basically like shows the button to release them to the released slaves and is like, do what you want. And she doesn't really take that responsibility. And then it kind of to me, gave a new light to the end of Rogue One, where, you know, you see her right after she has sent the Death Star plans up to Admiral Raddus in his black ship above Scarif, and she basically has the ability to kill Orson Krennic. And she, like, hesitates a little bit and then goes toward him, but then Cassian is like, he's not worth it. And this, to me, kind of, like, I see it through a whole new lens now, because, like, looking at Jyn's history, she doesn't really, like, she doesn't kill people who aren't trying to kill her, and you never do see her cross that line, as far as we're aware of her development, of becoming a murderer and becoming that ultimate evil. And she still always does have that spark of good in her that, I don't know, I kind of, like, watch that scene with a whole new light now.
Yeah, there's this kind of interesting dichotomy now between Jyn and Cassian where, you know, the first time I meet Cassian, he's literally shoots a dude in the back.
Whereas, who was his source?
Yes. And he's like, you know, ah, my arm is broken. Cool story. whereas Jyn never, she never shoots anyone who she can put a face to, where she can, like, really see that they're a human person. You know, in the case of the Imperial scientist who's trying to board Saw's ship, you know, she looks at him and she sees, you know, the scientist insignia on his uniform, and she's like, this guy's like my parents. You know, my parents were Imperial scientists. And that's what makes her hesitate. And then, yes, again, with the slavers, like, Revis does an incredible job of just kind of humanizing even a lot of the more evil characters in the novel. Like, the captain of the ships, you know, Jyn actually sits down and has a chat with him, and he says, you know, I used to be a slaver, and the other crew who are a little bit more rough around the edges, like, she kind of grows on them. Like, she makes them food and all that.
So that she can capture them and kill them, but not kill them.
Yeah, but ultimately, you know, she didn't have to do that. She probably could have just, probably could have murdered them in some other manner. I don't know. Star Wars has so many ways to murder people.
That's so true.
But yeah, no, it's fascinating.
I do prefer the airlock method, though. That was space. Mm-hmm. Death by space.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. I enjoyed the image that we were left with of them floating into space. It was made me happy.
Keeks is bloodthirsty, y'all.
I am. Sorry. Sorry, everyone. Not sorry at all.
And so I guess one kind of ending note of this episode, and was one thing we can end on when talk with kind of our whole Jyn-centric episode, is the ending. And this was one part, as I was reading, I I stopped and was like, I don't know that I saw that in Rogue One. And that's the ending where basically it's the scene in Rogue One where Jyn is being interrogated, questioned, basically, like, the rebels on Yavin are asking her to help them. And in the movie, she's very kind of, like, standoffish. And in fact, I kind of, rewatching Rogue One after reading the first half of the book, or rewatching this scene after rereading the first half of the book, I was really struck by the fact that she kind of, like, seems very blasé about everything until they mention Saw and having her go to talk to Saw, and then she gets really scared.
It's not really that she's scared, though. I saw it more as kind of, like, apprehension, you know? Like, she's just like, oh, here's the last person who, like, directly, you know, who I got close to, and they decided to fuck me over and cause me trauma. She never wanted to see him again. She didn't care if he was alive or not. You know, that was just a past she never wanted to revisit, I think, is more what it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. But then, like, in the book, in this scene that in the book, then you have her internal monologue to go with, you know, them asking her. And you get to the part where they say, daughter of Galen Erso, your father sent a message about a weapon into the Empire's building and how to destroy it. And you kind of have that's the switch flip moment for her, where she's like, I've spent so long not thinking about my father and hating him because he went to work for the Empire, and now maybe it was all a lie. And in the book, it says that it kind of, like, rekindles that hope in her. And I don't know, I was interested to get your guys' take on that, because I don't know that I necessarily saw that in the movie. I kind of saw it as her being like, this is what I need to do to, you know, be free. And, you know, I just have to do it. And I don't want to go see Saw, but I have to.
What do you think, Kate?
I mean, I don't know if that was the moment where her switch completely flipped. It's kind of hard to know. But I guess in the book it says that that's how it happened, but I think it was just kind of this cautious optimism on her part, you know, because she's so much like her father, honestly. Like, she's good with signs and numbers and things like that, and, you know, she wants to be like her mom. She's, like, throughout the book, she so badly wants to be as brave as her mom was when she stood up to Krennic when they came to get them on Lamu.
Which we agreed in episode one was very stupid.
Yes. Questionable parenting decisions. Star Wars. But she really is a lot like her father, and I can't help but wonder if that's part of the reason why she felt so deeply betrayed by him when she heard that he was working for the Empire. I wonder if she just wanted to completely disavow that part of herself. And she never can. You know, when Saw first refers to himself as her father, she's almost offended, you know? And so just, you know, first of all, knowing that her father's been, you know, on the good side this entire time, and that, you know, those parts of her aren't things that she needs to disavow anymore. I think that's really a huge part of the turning point for her.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly helps, right? So, yeah, I mean, I kind of go back to that part in Rogue One where she gets back on the ship after her dad dies, and Cassian just says, "You're in shock." And she's like, wait. I am in shock, probably, but, I mean, she probably is in shock, obviously. She just saw her dad die, and also found out that he was not a horrible traitor this whole time, which is great. Or was a horrible traitor, depending on which side you're standing on. But, I mean, I think it just, she had so much hardship in her life that, you know, what else is she really gonna do? She's so focused on staying alive for so much of her life that I think she was just kind of saying to herself, like, this is the next kind of logical thing. I have nothing else going on for me. And, you know, my basic needs are finally kind of provided for. And what else would I possibly do now that I know the truth?
Yeah, totally. I have no response to that.
I mean,
I feel like that's a good place to wrap up on Jin, you know? Like, I feel like we know so much more about her now, and now Rogue One takes on, like, a whole new meaning when you watch it, thanks to Beth Rivas and Rebel Rising.
Rogue One is so good.
Rogue One is so good. Rogue One is even better when you rewatch it. It's just so great.
I know. I think it's one of the more rewatchable, like, it really does get better every time I watch it, which is cool. Not that they all don't get better every time I watch them, but... you know, whatever.
You know.
Well, I think we can wrap up there. Thank you all for listening to episode 2 of the Book Wars podcast. This is hopefully the last one that we will have to re-record. So.
Oh my God,
we were human disasters.
Hopefully we figured out all our tech issues. We appreciate you bearing with us as we get these first 2 episodes up. And in future episodes, we will not have already had these discussions and know what we were going to say. So you'll hopefully find out even more about us and about Star Wars books. And next week, or next episode, probably not going to wait a week to record and load it up since it's taken so long to get the first 2 up. But we're just going to wrap up on Rogue One wrap up on Rebel Rising by Beth Rivas, a New York Times bestseller, and just talk about where it fits in the Star Wars universe, talk a little bit more about Beth Rivas's writing, about the story and about Jin and what we learned from this book.
Yeah, we're also going to be talking about what we have upcoming, which is the next book that we'll be reading is Bloodline by Claudia Gray, and we'll be talking about what we're excited about that and the questions that it's going to answer for us. So looking forward to that.
Find that off your library or go buy it at your local independent bookstore.
Yes, do that.
Support indies.
Support indies, that's right. Also, follow us at Book Wars Pod. Send your questions in via Twitter. You can also send them to us via email at bookwarspod@gmail.com. If you get those in before we go ahead and record episode 3, we can certainly get some of those answered on the air. We'd love to chat with you guys. So if you have questions, send them our way.
Awesome. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to the Book Wars Podcast. For Kristen and Kate, this is Chris. We will talk to you next episode.